Thank you for tuning in to Voices for Freedom, an anti-human trafficking podcast. We want to acknowledge that the content we discuss can be emotionally challenging and may evoke strong reactions. The stories we share often delve into tough subjects related to human trafficking, which may be difficult for some listeners to hear. Our goal is to raise awareness and promote understanding of the complexities surrounding human trafficking. Listener discretion is advised. Coming up on Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast.
And so all the women, they let them walk in to go get their suitcase. And then one of the main traffickers, I see him pull a padlock out of his pocket. And I'm thinking, what on earth is going on? And then I see him shut the door and he got the part where he was getting ready to lock them in. Literally locked them in. He went to put the padlock on and I got my finger in between. So he's pushing down on the padlock and trying to lock them in. And all I can think is if he gets this lock on, there's no way I can help these girls. Yeah.
Where is that first padlock today?
I put it in my pocket and my thought was this lock will never enslave someone again.
Welcome to Voices for Freedom, an anti-human trafficking podcast brought to you by Operation Underground Railroad. Along with my longtime colleague, Jessica Mass, I'm Matt Osborne. We are so excited to kick off this podcast series. We have an amazing lineup of episodes featuring experts in aftercare, law enforcement, cyber forensics, open source intelligence, and we're going to have a great time. Thank you so much for tuning in. For this first episode, we are going to kind of interview each other. Most of the episodes, you'll see either Jessica or me interviewing the guests. Some are Operation Underground Railroad employees and contractors. Others are outside partners. We're here to raise awareness about the issue of child exploitation and human trafficking. In OUR, we've been around for 10 years now as we start to move through 2024. I've had a chance to work with Jessica for years. It's not hyperbole or, you know, false piety, you know, trying to suck up for points to say that this individual is someone I look up to more than almost anyone else in the world, because we have been undercover. We have been in the darkest layers of evil, and we'll talk a little bit about that throughout today. But Jessica, thank you so much for agreeing to do this and to co-host, and you have such an amazing background. If you don't mind kind of starting out, what brought you to OUR? What were you doing beforehand? What are some of the many jobs you've had at OUR throughout the years? And we'll just kind of start there and we'll roll through and we'll do a few segments as we go through today, this first ever episode of Voices for Freedom.
Well, thank you, Matt. And I think it's fun because people get to see some of the behind the scenes of OUR and hopefully learn a lot more about what trafficking actually is. Yep. And how it is different in so many different countries, regions, what it looks like in the United States. So I'm excited that we have this opportunity to be able to do this. So I came on with OUR in 2015.
Man, hard to believe it's been that long, huh?
I know. It seems like yesterday, and then it seems like a lifetime ago.
I think you and I are two of maybe the longest serving employees, maybe two out of the three, something like that. But we've been around a long time.
Yep, and we've seen a lot. So some of my background is I started working in nonprofit when I had moved to Florida. I was working down there in 2001 and I've worked throughout the United States in six different states working with everything from sexual exploitation to extreme poverty to human trafficking. And I worked within the foster care system at first and saw so many of the different things that were happening to these children when they were with their biological family, and then also how difficult it was for them to be in foster care, some of their vulnerabilities that they had. And then I also lived in Africa right before coming on with OUR.
That's right.
So 2014, I lived in Africa, and then when I was moving back, somebody had told OUR about me and my background with working with kids for so long and all the different vulnerabilities and human trafficking, sexual exploitation. That I got the opportunity to come on with OUR.
Yeah, and over the years, and again, we've obviously gone through a lot of changes or continuing to go through changes. We just announced our new CEO, Tammy Lee. We're so excited to have her here, whole new board of directors. But talk about those early days as really you were building from scratch our aftercare program. And what I always say, you know, I was former CIA. We had former Homeland Security, Navy SEALs. We didn't know anything about aftercare. We thought the host countries could take care of the survivors themselves. Once we realized in late 2014, early 2015, that that wasn't the case, we knew we had to create an aftercare program, and we're grateful for you coming in on the ground level. But what were the things you experienced in those early months and years to build up our aftercare team in the U.S. and around the world?
So when I first came on with OUR, I kind of thought that there was already an aftercare program in place, and what I found out is there wasn't really an aftercare program. OUR was still brand new, a startup company at that time, about a year old, year and a half old when I came on.
Yeah.
And so I looked at all the different operations that you and the ops teams were doing around the world and trying to figure out on our shoestring budget, how are we going to support the survivors that are having interventions, being rescued through OUR operations. And to run an aftercare home, on average, it's about $500,000 a year.
Wow.
I would say that's an average. So some more, some less.
Okay.
And to think about all those countries that you guys were working in and our small budget, there was no way we could start from the ground up aftercare homes. And then from my previous experience with living internationally, working with other organizations, working in nonprofit for so many years, my background helped me realize and remember that the best way to help survivors of all these different situations is to really go in and see who's already doing the work.
Right.
And so the aftercare program that I developed in the beginning was really first go sit at the feet of the experts in each country, listen, be as humble as you can, and say, how can we support you? How can we build up quality care? So we would vet different aftercare homes. We still vet different aftercare homes before we partner with them. But we want to honor them as the experts in their country, and we want to make sure that we are supporting them, not trying to say we know better about trafficking in your country and how to help survivors in your region. And so the aftercare program, that was the origins of it. And then we were able to help build aftercare homes, remodel aftercare homes, provide finances for survivors to go to everything from elementary school to university to trade school, building libraries and 15-passenger vans so that they could have community excursions and make sure that they're not just institutionalized within the home. And so there's all these different things that we helped with, mental health providers, so that it would be holistic aftercare, but it was always, how can we support you? And we really built genuine, authentic relationships with the founders and aftercare home directors. We worked a lot with the kids when we would visit them to make sure that if there was any complaints, because kids don't have a filter, they'll tell you if something's going on. And they'll also tell you their dreams. And it really helped empower both myself and the whole aftercare team to be able to say, how can we actually help? Because we want to help. We don't want to hurt.
Correct.
We want to empower. We don't want to take away from anything. Or if OUR support suddenly wasn't there, we want to make sure that that aftercare home is still able to support themselves and hopefully have a better program because we partnered with them.
Yeah, and I remember those early years too. You were all about collaboration. We always said we would go through the back entrance first, meaning we would look at the aftercare infrastructure in the country. And there were a couple countries early on, and you remember, we won't name them, but they wanted us to come support with operations, but we refused because they didn't have the aftercare infrastructure in place. And we've done a lot, and you know, throughout the episodes on this podcast, we'll talk a little bit more about aftercare. I know that coming up in a few episodes down the line, you're going to interview an expert on one of our partner organizations, and that's what we really do, right? We collaborate. We have some expertise and areas of expertise, but we don't know everything, and we're not in all the countries, and that's what I loved about what you did, is you'd find the aftercare experts in each country, because everything's different, correct? And then talk about how you pave the way then for what I used to do, leading the operations teams, to make sure that if at all times we were doing everything that did not re-traumatize victims and that would set things up so that your team could come in and really always have a victim-centered and trauma-informed approach.
Yeah, and it's been a fun journey because you learn so much along the way. You learn how to apologize as well if you make mistakes, and hopefully you get forgiveness.
Yeah, and we made a lot of mistakes in the early years. We say that with full, you know, candor and transparency.
Yeah, so that's a little bit of my background. Why don't you tell us about you, Matt, and some of your background? Because I remember when we first started, and one of the things I remember hearing is, he's former CIA. And I was like, I have no idea what all that entails outside of the movies I've seen. So he's former CIA. Do we need to like hide our phones? Is he a spy? What's going on?
Right.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up at OUR.
Well, as you know from knowing me since 2015, I'm not cool, but the background's cool. I get a lot of gravitas from that. And so 12 years with the CIA and U.S. Department of State, and yes, I saw some of the James Bond movies growing up, the Jason Bourne movies, and I wanted to do that. Then I realized I'm not nearly as cool as those guys. But having a really interesting time after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, how that galvanized me to want to do something for my country. And I worked for a Republican, George W. Bush. I worked for a Democrat, Barack Obama. For me, it wasn't political. It was about U.S. national security. So I worked issues of, you know, terrorism against the homeland, illegal narcotics, organized crime. And then I went to Spain, and in the U.S. Embassy in Spain, I was asked to work something called trafficking in persons, write the tip report for the U.S. Department of State. I'm embarrassed now to say, but back then, I thought it was prostitution. I thought it was a movie, Pretty Woman. You remember the Julia Roberts character who decided when she'd work, who she'd have to sleep with, how much she'd charge, that she'd get to keep all the money. As you know, that really doesn't happen anymore. There's always a pimp. There's always a trafficker. There's normally exploitation involved. Well, I have two daughters who are now college age. If anyone, and I don't know how good the cameras are, if the gray hair and the sideburns gives you any indication, but raising daughters through these dangerous times of social media that we'll talk about in subsequent episodes and in demand and pornography, I really felt God was calling me to try and focus on human trafficking. So I got a call in 2013, 2014 was asked to join this organization that was just starting up. And I thought, wait a sec, Uncle Sam pays me faithfully twice a month. I've got a pension waiting for me in just 6 years. If I stick it out, I'd have government health care the rest of my life. But I thought, no, there's something more to life. You've got to dedicate to where you think God's calling you. So it was a big leap of faith to join an organization where I only got paid if the donations come in. But that's what I did in August of 2014, and have done a lot of jobs like you, but really led our operations teams. In our next segment, we'll talk about one of the most, in my mind, sort of dangerous, complicated, serious operations you and I helped lead. But haven't looked back since. Been very grateful. It's an amazing organization. It's a wonderful time. And that's really what this podcast series will be. And so I'm grateful to partner with you on this. And we're going to wrap up this first segment. But when we come back, we again will go deep undercover, as it were. And Jessica and I will talk about Sage's Prayer, an amazing, daring, harrowing operation. Not because anything about great how we are, but these amazing women, the courageous women, the survivors who featured in that operation. So don't go anywhere. We'll be back soon. Voices for Freedom, an anti-human trafficking podcast brought to you by Operation Underground Railroad. A big thanks to our sponsor, Our Rescue Store, for supporting our podcast. The Our Rescue Store is committed to responsibly sourcing products that ignite conversations about human trafficking, raising awareness, and contributing to the movement against it. With more than enough colors, designs, and items to choose from, there's definitely something for you. Find something you'll be proud to own and be an advocate for change. Visit store.ourrescue.org and use the promo code VOICES10 for 10% off your purchase. That's VOICES10 on store.ourrescue.org.
Welcome back to the Voices for Freedom podcast. We are so excited that we are getting the opportunity to have this conversation with you all today. And I want to start off with asking you, Matt. We did a operation called Operation Praying Sage. It was an operation you and I were both on, probably one of the most dangerous operations that we've ever done. And so would you walk us through a little bit of that? How did that get started? The undercover work, all of that side of things of Operation Praying Sage.
Yeah, I think, and that's another reason why in the first segment you heard us talking about the bond that you and I have. It's because we were in some really dangerous areas, and I'm not prone to hyperbole or drama, but in that Operation Praying Sage, I didn't know if I was going to make it home, and I didn't know if I was going to be killed or wind up in a Haitian prison. And honestly, it was 50-50 on what I would have chosen, right, the situation. But just briefly, we had gotten intelligence from our undercover team in Haiti that there was a bar, a club called Reginald's Place. Reginald was a suspected trafficker. And there were what we were told Latina girls, women from Dominican Republic and Venezuela. We confirmed the presence of these women. We have different ways when we're undercover so we don't exploit the women, traumatize them any more than they already are traumatized. We're not going to do anything with them. But we were able to ascertain and determine they did not want to be there. There were 10 women. They had 14, 15 kids between them, and we knew they wanted out. But when we went in there, we had to go a couple of different nights just to kind of get the layout. And that is what I remember that brought us to that point. And this was about the time we started to bring you in and the aftercare team to start to prepare. But there still was a lot we needed to do in the club to get the evidence we needed.
That's insane as far as all the different things that you have to do. One thing that you guys do that I've always respected about the ops team is you make sure that you have top cover.
Right.
So what happened with having top cover? What changed? What are the things that you felt like were why did it get dangerous? Because usually operations go in, the police, law enforcement arrest the bad guys, survivors come with me or aftercare support services, and it's pretty cut and dry as far as operations. This one, to say that you didn't know if you were going to come home alive, I agree with that. I didn't know if I would. But how did we get to that point?
Yeah, and it's important, too, when you talk about top cover, and our audience might say, well, what does that mean? Well, Operation Underground Railroad is not a vigilante organization. We go in through the front door or we don't go in at all. We have no arrest authority on our own. We are not a law enforcement entity. We support law enforcement. So our top cover are police units, prosecutors, politicians who have authority to let us be there. We're signed up as confidential sources of information. So in this case, and we had worked previous operations in Haiti, and you and I were involved in some of those, one where we got real arrested that maybe we can talk about too, as opposed to being fake arrested as our operators are oftentimes to keep the ruse going. But we were able to get two judges who worked in the district, who had jurisdiction over the district where Reginald's Club was operating and where these women were being exploited. So we met with them on a few different occasions beforehand to get signed up, to get the permission. But it wasn't until we actually had sort of physical evidence of these women wanting to get out. And you remember the story of the note, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we gave that and showed you that a day or two later. I'll just really quickly tell that story. So our operators were there, and one operator had a note slipped to him. And it was something in his hand, and he went to the bathroom, and he opened it up. Well, he didn't speak Spanish, but he went and he asked me, what does it say? And it said, ayúdanos, por favor, which means help us, please. And this is incredible. In the past, we've had victims, tell us, get us out of here. We don't want to be here. But this was a note that said, help us, please. So we immediately called back to headquarters. We told you. And just the power of that, I tell you, in all the operations I've led, it's been over 20 with Operation Underground Railroad over the past 10 years, have never had something like that. But then, as you mentioned, the judges, we thought they were with us, but then we weren't really sure. And unfortunately, you took the brunt of it when you realized the judges weren't on our side. So take us through, once the strike team goes in on that Friday night, once we secure the place, first of all, there were no other clients there other than our operators. So that night, that should have been red flags right there. Someone was tipped off, right? Because that place would have been bouncing with normal clients. Reginald wasn't there, okay? That's another thing. He's always there, we had heard on a Friday night. Tell us about once the women were all brought into the courtyard and you were there. You had an interpreter who spoke Haitian Creole, Spanish, and English, so you could talk to Haitian authorities, the Venezuelan survivors, and, of course, our team. But what did the judges say? How did they treat you? And when did you realize, oh, no, we're in some trouble here?
Yeah, so the operation happened, and I was thinking the bad guys, the traffickers, had already been arrested. So that's when I go in. That's typically the standard procedure of how it happened. So I went in, and a few minutes in, realized the man I was talking to, who was Haitian but spoke English, he was one of the traffickers. He was one of the main guys.
Yep.
And he was now talking to the judges, the law enforcement, and basically telling them what to do. So he was saying things like, they can't leave. They're in debt bondage. Mm-hmm. They don't have their passports. So
and
we
didn't even say they're
them.
The property, right, their mm-hmm. own. And you think, wait a sec, this is like 1800s United States, right, where it's their property. I mean, that was unbelievable. And when you're walkie-talking back to us, I was outside with the unit, you know, getting ready with the trucks that were able to take the women to safety. I just can't imagine. How did you keep your cool at that moment? How did you continue to negotiate when essentially the traffickers telling the judge, those women are our property, and the judge is turning to you, those women are his property?
That is exactly what happened. How I kept my cool, I honestly don't know. I think sometimes you get put in these situations and then you see how you'll react. But I remember being there, and I think it was a miraculous experience as far as I wasn't fearful for some reason. It was, this is the time that you fight for justice. Mm-hmm. And I remember that feeling just overwhelming me of, you see these women? If you leave them, they're going to be beat. They might be killed. Their lives will never be free.
Right.
And so I think when you're standing there and you're facing these traffickers and this corruption that's happening, you have this sense of, are you willing to do what your mission says?
Right.
Are you actually willing to put your life on the line? Or is it all just, oh, if it's easy, then we'll help. Oh, if there's no problems, then we'll help. Or is it, we will go to the darkest corners. We will
right.
help those that no one else is coming for. And so seeing those survivors and hearing them say, please don't leave us.
Yeah.
And my broken Spanish, as you know, I was...
You're quite good. Don't sell yourself short. Mucho gracias. That's good.
Matt's helped me with a lot of my Spanish and specifically correcting me, which has been good. But hearing them say, please don't leave us.
Right.
And seeing their faces of bravery, that they would stand up and say all those things while the traffickers are there saying, we own you.
Mm-hmm.
While the law enforcement, judges, all those people were there saying, sorry, you can't leave. And those girls being so brave. I just don't think you can leave anyone. And that's when that sense of we will stand up for justice really rose up inside.
Yeah, and you didn't leave them and you put yourself at risk. And you remember there were a lot of miracles throughout, a lot of people praying for us. The operation, obviously, praying Sage. Sage Robbins was home praying. But you remember we said a prayer back in headquarters. And I actually don't know if you remember this one was happening because you weren't on the headsets of our headquarters team. We had someone say a prayer, and the minute they concluded the prayer, and again, I'm not making this up, it was literally the minute the prayer was concluded, hey, soften the judge's heart, let him see why we need to get these girls out. The judge said, I'm tired, it's late, you know what, whatever you want, you can take the women. Unbelievable. Now, we didn't have their passports, but we made a decision right there and then. Let's get the women out of this hell. We've already got different clothes for them. We've got different hotels and safe houses. But talk about when you went in, because the women said, remember, we'll leave. And you asked them all, because didn't the judge say, hey, they can go with you as long as they say they want to go. And you asked them, and all of them, see, right? Yes, yes, yes. You go in because they said, all we want to do is just take our stuff because their whole life was in one suitcase. Tell us briefly about that when you went in. And again, you think, is that the beginning of the end there? No, that's the end of the beginning of their trials, that you almost got locked in. The women almost got locked in that brothel, didn't you, when you went in?
Correct, yes. So the judge, yeah, he was getting tired. He said, fine, you can take them. You're not going to have the passports. But if the women verbally say they want to go, then they can leave. So we were in the courtyard, and then we had to walk through the main room where the brothel was, and then in the back is where the women would be held and would sleep. That was their living quarters. So we're walking through the brothel, and then there's a bar area right before going to where the women sleep. And so all the women, they let them walk in to go get their suitcase, and then one of the main traffickers, I see him pull a padlock out of his pocket. And I'm thinking, what on earth is going on? And then I see him shut the door, and he got the part where he was getting ready to lock them in, literally lock them in. And I don't know how this happened. I couldn't explain it. I don't think it was of my own strength, but he went to put the padlock on, and I got my finger in between. So he's pushing down on the padlock and trying to lock them in. And all I can think is if he gets this lock on, there's no way I can help these girls.
Because they'll say, sorry, we know the judges and the military, who's their police. Sorry, they don't have the key. You know what? Oh, well.
Yep.
And for your finger. So again, not hyperbole, not drama, but that operation was saved literally by the width of a finger.
Yeah. I mean, and for that part of it, and I thought he was going to break my finger because he was pushing on it so hard. And then somehow I was able to rip the lock out of his hand, and how myself being able to rip a lock out of a man's hand, I have no idea how that happened. But then I see from across the room, somebody throws another padlock to one of the security guards on their team. And there was a full door, and they were going to try and lock them in that full door. And so where it's like, okay, we got the one lock, and then that's when I jumped up on top of the bar to go up and against that trafficker.
And we've got video and audio, and you're saying, no, no, stop, stop. And we only saw that afterwards. Where is that first padlock today?
Somebody at OUR has it.
Yeah, but you have it. You walked out with it, and it's now in our sort of museum, so to speak. But
yeah, I put it in my pocket, and my thought was, this lock will never enslave someone again.
Yeah. It was a harrowing 4 or 5 days after that, where we're running from hotel to hotel, safe house to safe house, not knowing again if we were going to be killed or wind up in a Haitian prison. There is a documentary called Sage's Prayer out there. We're going to start distributing that more widely. Spoiler alert, we do survive the operation, but just incredible. We'll do future episodes, hopefully, on some of what the survivors are doing today. They're doing so well, as you know. And you and I were on an ops call just a couple days ago, and we found out that Reginald, who wasn't arrested in our original op because of corruption, fortunately was arrested subsequently, and he's getting his day in Haitian court finally in the coming weeks, and we really hope justice will be done. So anyway, that was crazy, but just such an honor to serve with you on that operation.
Oh, same to you, Matt. And those survivors are absolutely incredible. You think about how brave they are, and throughout any operation that we've been involved with, the true heroes are the survivors. And not just in that moment, but the long term, and how they go through their healing process and that journey. So thank you all for listening to this part of our podcast, and hopefully you are finding this educational and that you'll feel like you understand a little bit more of what OUR does, but also what trafficking looks like. And we're going to talk about different countries and what it looks like in different countries so that there is a more broad understanding of what human trafficking is. So stay tuned, and we will be back right after this.
I want to thank our sponsor, The Our Store, for supporting this podcast. Did you know the Our Rescue Store features survivor-made items? In this critical fight, they serve as symbols of hope. By choosing to purchase one of these beautifully handcrafted items, you will impact the healing journey of survivors and help them reclaim their lives in the process. We encourage you to shop survivor-made items on the Our Rescue website. It might only be a few dollars to you, but it makes a world of difference to them. And in case you need any extra motivation, use promo code VOICES10 for 10% off your purchase at store.ourrescue.org. That's VOICES10 at store.ourrescue.org.
Thank you for tuning in to Voices for Freedom, an anti-human trafficking podcast. We want to acknowledge that the content we discuss can be emotionally challenging and may evoke strong reactions. The stories we share often delve into tough subjects related to human trafficking, which may be difficult for some listeners to hear. Our goal is to raise awareness and promote understanding of the complexities surrounding human trafficking. Listener discretion is advised.
And welcome back to Voices for Freedom, an anti-human trafficking podcast brought to you by Operation Underground Railroad. My partner, Jessica Mass, and I have been talking over the past couple segments about our backgrounds, both on the aftercare side and the operation side, talking about Operation Praying Sage in Haiti. But for this last segment, I mean, for the years we've been there, I'll speak for you as well right now. I'm sure there are thousands of really impactful moments, but maybe what is one or what are two that come to mind? We can just kind of go back and forth, but just to give the audience an idea of some of the miracles, some of the things, the hard moments, the joys, the scary times, the sad times. But what is one thing that has stood out about, you know, your time and your career here at Operation Underground Railroad?
Well, there are definitely a lot. And I think what comes to mind first is what I've said is the survivors are the real heroes in that. And human trafficking looks so different in so many different regions of the world. So I remember my first operation that I was getting ready to go on and help with aftercare was to Africa.
That's right.
And I was reading their case files. I made the mistake of going to Barnes & Noble, and I was going to read the case file and have this great atmosphere, very relaxing. And I open up their file, and I start reading about child sacrifice. And I had never worked with any child that had been sacrificed before. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know the context of human trafficking of child sacrifice and how that all went together. And so I remember reading one of the files about how a child was kidnapped from their home, and then that kidnapper sold that person to a witch doctor who then cut open the back of their head and drained their blood into a mason jar. And then they would cut off their genitals, and they would sell the blood and the genitals to a buyer. And so there was these multiple different situations that this kid went through and trauma. And as I'm sitting there in Barnes & Noble, I just started weeping because of trying to imagine what these kids would go through, and also saying, how can I even help? What can I do to help in aftercare for these children? And there's been miracle after miracle with different situations of kids that have lived through this. Mm-hmm. A lot of times the girls won't survive because of the amount of blood that they lose and how they're mutilating the genitals. And so there's a few girls that I've worked with that have lived through this. There's lots of boys that I've worked with. But I remember finding out that there was a place in Australia that our partners worked with that were able to do genital reconstruction surgery.
Yeah, yes.
And that was kind of the first hope that I had. And it said to me, if they can help in that situation, what can we do? And so we've been able to have kids come over here from a few different countries that have had surgeries, and we've got to be a part of that and seeing them going from not being able to walk to be able to walk. There's children that we've seen that have been adopted that you just think, wow, because of OUR and really saying, I don't think we can help. But then these kids seeing their lives completely transformed. And when I was at that aftercare home in Africa, I remember walking in and seeing those kids for the first time. And they were happy. They were up playing soccer. They were doing crafts.
I've seen some of the footage. It's wonderful.
And so that impacted my life so much because it gave me hope. Mm-hmm. Hope for those kids, but hope with the hundreds of other kids that we work with, where it says, it said to me, if they can have joy, then let's fight with them for joy and for healing and for whether that's surgeries, whether that's mental health therapy, whatever that looks like, let's fight alongside them. So that's been one of my most impactful.
You talk about for the one, right? If we would have done all of this just for that one or just for any one of those kids there. That's incredible. Well, I was thinking as well, and none of mine are going to be, again, as impactful as yours because it deals with these amazing survivors. But one that I referenced in one of the earlier segments, you know, getting real arrested, right, with you. Again, we get fake arrested oftentimes because we can't let the traffickers know that it was a setup, right? We have to let them know or let them believe that that we were also getting arrested and taken to the U.S. Embassy or deported back to the U.S. but an Operation Toussaint, as you know, and the predecessor to that, in February of 2017, we had the whole operation site set up, but it was so big that the unit we were working with, their Child Protection Brigade, could only secure part of it. Well, the military, you remember, then they brought in to secure the rest of it, but didn't tell the Army that the Americans, the gringos, right, les blancs, were working with law enforcement. So when we left, after we got arrested, the owner of the club thought that we were leaving without paying, even though we had left money in the rooms, we'd actually overpaid the whole thing. So they said, arrest him, arrest him, arrest him. And you remember, you and I got pulled out of a car, got thrown down, literally, right, had rifles in our backs. And I remember looking over at you, and you had on your baseball cap, and your bill was the only thing holding your head up. And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, how are we going to get out of this? Our advance team had already gone. I didn't speak Haitian Creole. The French that I had was leaving me at the time. How am I going to communicate to them? And I just said a prayer. I said, Lord, please, somehow, we're trying to rescue your precious children. We've had an amazing success. We've gotten 29 girls out of this. Traffickers have been arrested. However, half of our team is here caught behind enemy lines, and we can't get out. And as soon as I finished praying, Guess No Marty, if any of you know the story of that, the father of Gardy Marty, and he speaks Creole and French and English, and he was not even supposed to be in that area of the club and the resort. He's supposed to be probably 2 kilometers away. This place was so vast. He pulls up, and I remember seeing him at the corner of his eye and saying in English, Guess No, can you please tell this guy who's got his gun in my back and next to you that we're with the good guys, we're working. And then about 30 seconds later, they let us go. And I remember thinking a whole lot of things, right? The miracles, the power of prayer. But also, we always say in Operation Underground Railroad, we'll take calculated risks. We won't take dumb risks. Was that a dumb risk? But it's what you mentioned just a minute ago. We're willing to do those things. We're willing to take those risks because we don't have a death wish. But if, God forbid, something happens to us, you know, at least we can tell our maker, hey, we were doing the best we can. And that's what we did in that point. But when I joke that I've been arrested 9 times in 6 different countries on these operations, it's true. But one time briefly being detained was not. And I don't know if you have any memories of that time there, but that was really, really dicey. And I think in my mind, at least, that's what solidified my partnership with you on the ops and the aftercare side forever.
Well, I definitely remember that. It's something you don't forget when you have a gun to your back. And I do remember the owner running up and screaming, they need to pay, they need to pay. And you being you, of course, you overpaid and you left money in the room because you're always very by the book and make sure everybody has their fair share and things are taken care of the right way. So I remember him running up, and I do remember very clearly getting pulled out of that van and the few of us that were face down on the ground and trying to move my head, but I had this hat on to cover up my hair, and they kept yelling at me, get your head down. My neck was hurting.
I know.
But I will say, had you not seen Gesno, you not seen him, and however he shows up.
I know, total miracle.
I don't know what would have happened. Yeah. And I do remember being face down and thinking, this could be it. Like this, like you're processing, because this doesn't go into your mind as you're planning an op, but then you're processing what's happening. And I was so grateful for you that day that you handled it. It's one of those things where I was like, I somehow feel a little safe because Matt's here and he's going to figure out how to get us out of this.
Well, we have a few more minutes still. Is there another one that comes to mind? I'm thinking of one I'll probably share at the end, but do you have another one? Because what you shared was so powerful. Of the thousands of memories and other highlights and even some lowlights that we've had over the years, anything finally you want to share here as we start to wrap up?
Well, one of the most impactful things for me that I had no idea about trafficking was in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And how we first started working there was we got a call of a survivor that had tried to end her life, and she was going to try and wrap a sheet around her neck, and it didn't work. And so as she was trying to do that, she told us that she said, if I can't even end my life because of how awful I'm being treated here. It was a survivor from Africa, trafficked to the Middle East, being held in sexual slavery, and labor trafficking, just this horrible situation. And so she said, if I can't end my life, then God, please help me escape tomorrow. And And if there's any chance, please just give me eyes to see, the time to get out. So the person that was holding her in slavery had left the house, and she went out through the window, running down the street, screaming in English, because she spoke English. The majority of the people there spoke Arabic. And so nobody was even understanding what she was saying. Well, there was a man and a woman, a married couple there from Ireland, who heard her screaming. They took her into their home, and the one of the people from where she was being held had chased her and went up to that door of the people from Ireland, and they started pounding on the door. "Give us back our slave. Give us back our slave," is what they were yelling. And this brave man from Ireland said, "Over my dead body, will you take her?" And then that person ended up contacting some of our operators, and then the operators at OUR contacted me for aftercare. I ended up getting to meet her. She's amazing. There's so many different stories I could tell about her and how she has provided an amazing life for her son and all the different situations around that. But she is really a hero. She is somebody that, because of her and her bravery, so many other people have been set free because of what she did and running down the street.
Yeah, Jessica, that's incredible. And you know, we're a non-denominational, nonpartisan organization, but I hope people can see that we are believe in prayer, we believe in miracles, and we're going to continue to do all we can. And I'm just excited here as we start to wrap up this first episode to think about what we have in front of us now for Voices for Freedom. So, Jessica, thank you. Good luck in the weeks to come as you'll be hosting episodes, and I'll do the same, and we'll start to put it all together. So, thank you, partner.
Thanks for listening. Did you enjoy this episode? If so, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have ideas for future episodes, email us at voicesforfreedom@ourrescue.org. Lastly, we encourage you to join the fight. Make a difference today by donating at ourrescue.org or text podcast to 855-944-5646. Again, that number is 855-944-5646.
Join us for the next episode of Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast, where I have the privilege of interviewing undercover operator codename Alex from Southeast Asia. Alex will take us deep into one of the most iconic and emblematic rescue missions ever led by Our Rescue. Join us next time.